Greetings once again to all of you out there from right here in the middle of it all. You may have heard the news. Stand by now for the worldview. It is the Weekly Worldview, and I am your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back to the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. So glad to have you back, and it's such a, well, we've just finished out a tumultuous week, and I don't know about around the nation, but here at the McBurney compound, it's been a tumultuous week, as my extremely attractive audio engineer has returned to the controls, and she brought all my girls back from a faraway land, a distant land. My 9-year-old Nicole still adjusting to speaking English with the children in the neighborhood, and she's come back with, well, I mean, she's somewhat fluent again in Japanese, and it's so good to have everybody back as we try to stumble back toward normalcy. Perhaps tonight will be the night when we get to bed before 2 and wake up before 10. It'd be quite interesting to see if we can manage that. And I know it's been a tumultuous week for the nation as well as the conservative tsunami that was expected in the midterm elections of 2010 turned out to be, just a moderate surf lapping up against the shores of impending tyranny. But we'll get to all that. We'll get to all that, but I want to start with something. I always like to start with something uplifting and off the subject. So I'm going to start here in Paris, France, from the Reuters Wire. A 15-month-old baby girl survived a fall from a 7th-floor apartment in Paris unscathed after bouncing off a cafe awning into the arms of a passerby. Yeah. Somehow the 15-month-old baby fell out of a window. A young man walking by saw the baby starting to fall and alerted his father, who raced to get into position, arms outstretched, to catch the baby after she hit the awning. This was reported in Le Parisien, a newspaper there in the greater Paris metro area. The girl appears, at last report, to have no serious injuries. And there you have it, okay? So all is not lost, okay? Now to get on, should I get on to serious? I'm thinking to just go to the war file because it's something I can relate to. Whereas politics and the election, I mean, I actually turned the TV to Fox News the other day, and I almost vomited. I had a reaction in my stomach. I had to turn it off because I just can't take it anymore. I can't take politics. I can't take the elections anymore. I was into it for at least the last 30 days, but I'm out of it as of the moment anyways. So perhaps I'll do that. Before we talk anything about elections or politics or the Republicans and the Democrats and the Tea Party and all that, let's jump right into the war file for something we can relate to. Dateline San Diego, California, from the Associated Press. The new commandant of the Marine Corps says now is not the time to overturn the don't ask, don't tell, don't seek, don't smell policy. General James Amos, who just recently took the helm as Marine Corps commandant, said of the don't ask, don't tell policy, quote, "I don't know what the effect of that will be on cohesion." Cohesion! Now I can't get my mind around this. Here's the commandant of my Marine Corps talking about whether or not it's okay to let boys, let's not get into all that, but maybe I can't get my mind around the war file either. Maybe it's all just too much for me, and I need to just hang up the headphones, turn off the microphone, and go back to leading my normal daily life. The Marine Corps, according to the AP, is exempt from a Defense Department rule that troops have private living quarters. Were you aware of this? That the Defense Department has a rule that troops, and I'm talking enlisted dog-faced troops, E1, E2, boots for crying out loud, have private living quarters, but not in the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps puts at least two people in each room to promote a sense of unity. Unity, that is. Not cohesion, at least not in the don't ask, don't tell vein of thought. I mean, there's certain kind of there's certain types of cohesion that I think we could do without, and a boy-on-boy cohesion is something that the Marine Corps just doesn't need. And it's just depressing that the Commandant of the Marine Corps is put in a position to say that, to say that the homos can serve in the closet instead of openly, instead of being able to say, like a Commandant of the Marine Corps should say, that we don't tolerate sexual immorality in the Marine Corps, especially that of the homosexual variety. Well, he can't say that anymore. Now he's just trying to hold the line on the don't ask, don't tell, don't seek, don't smell policy that we were all so upset about some 15 or 20 years ago, however long ago. Anyway, the Commandant will make recommendations to Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who is a fan of boy-on-boy cohesion in the barracks. And, I don't know, perhaps General James Amos will make a sensible recommendation to Defense Secretary Robert Gates and will be summarily relieved of command in short order for bringing some sense to the discussion and saying, look, can't we just keep the queers out of the barracks, please? Please, Mr. Gates. All right. Now, more from the war file. The war goes on, by the way. From Reuters, an Al-Qaeda attack last Monday killed 52 hostages and police in a Catholic church in Baghdad and apparently was aimed at driving the Christian minority out of the country. So now that we have a semi-democratically elected cabal of Muslims there in Iraq, the activity on the street is that the Muslims are working to drive the Christians out of Iraq altogether. And this was the bloodiest attack against Iraq's Christians Now listen to what Reuters tells us here. This is the bloodiest attack against Iraq's Christians in the 7 years of sectarian war that followed the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq. So for all of my Christian brethren out there, were you aware that one of the main side effects of the U.S. invasion of Iraq was 7 years of sectarian war against Christians? Authorized, although I'm certain not promoted, but certainly authorized through action or inaction by the United States government. We have a quote here from Human Rights Minister Wijan Michael. He's a Christian, the human rights minister there in Iraq. He said, what happened here was more than a catastrophic and tragic event. He says, in my opinion, quote, it is an attempt to force Iraqi Christians to leave Iraq and to empty Iraq of Christians. And so is that going to end well for Iraq? The disillusion and disappearance of the entire Christian community in that country. And in the long view of history, will George W. Bush and the United States military be somewhat to blame for the eradication of Christianity in Iraq? Well, I certainly hope not, but that seems to be the way it's going. Not unlike the United States government is primarily responsible for eradicating Christianity wherever it can, here on our shores, for crying out loud. All right. Let's move on into the war file, deeper even. Not to put too fine a point on it, but deeper and deeper into the never-ending war against Islamofascism. This dateline is from Guantanamo Bay from the McClatchy News Service. A military jury last Sunday gave terrorist Omar Khadr a 40-year prison sentence for killing an American commando in Afghanistan. But the sentence was merely symbolic. The United States has already agreed to limit Khadr's prison time to 8 years, and Canada said it would allow Khadr to serve out the bulk of his sentence there in Canada. This is a convicted terrorist from Guantanamo Bay who's been sentenced to 40 years, but because of the vagaries of the justice system being applied there in Guantanamo Bay, apparently he could be out already as we go to air. He could already be walking around the streets of Toronto looking for a latte. There was an agreement that will allow Kadir to be released from prison by the age of 32, if not earlier, under Canadian parole provisions. Let's see here. The widow of Kadir's victim, Tabitha Spear, she cheered as Kadir was sentenced to 40 years, but she had no idea that there's a deal in the works that this terrorist murderer could be out of prison before the ink is dry on his conviction and sentence. Let's see. Kadir was Guantanamo's youngest captive, just a mere child. He was only 15 years old when he hurled a grenade that killed a commando, Sergeant First Class Christopher Spear, back in 2002. Now, if someone hurls a grenade and kills a commando, why is he on trial? Am I confused? I mean, why wasn't he just shot right then or shortly after his capture? Perhaps we've forgotten how it is that a war is fought and won, and perhaps all is lost. Well, maybe not. Let's jump into the justice file as we dig for some good news. Philip Halford, this is from the Associated Press, Atmore, Alabama. Philip Halford was pronounced dead earlier last week at Holman, Alabama prison, and he declined to say any final words. He had apparently insisted on his innocence. He was sentenced to die for forcing his then 15-year-old daughter to lure her boyfriend, Eddie Shannon, to an isolated area where he shot the teen three times and threw his body off a bridge. He said he was angry because they were dating. His daughter says that the father, the murderer who has been executed, had been abusing her for years and had never admitted to it. So Philip Halford has gone on to meet his maker. So there is some justice. When was he convicted here? Convicted in 1980. Let's see here. Well, I've lost it. 1987, for crying out loud. 1987. Wow, that's a long time to be on death row. Justice delayed is justice denied. Although, the very night that Mr. Hallman met his maker, some justice was restored. And that was last Thursday, by the way. All right. More from now, from one extreme to the other, although I shouldn't say it that way because executing a convicted murderer is anything but extreme. Pretty sensible in my economy. But let's say from one end of the spectrum to another, from Atlanta, the Associated Press, authorities say a driver who was enraged because a 17-year-old boy egged his Mercedes on Halloween fatally shot the prankster in the neck and throat as the young egg thrower tried to run away. The driver confronted the teen and fired 10 shots at him. And Tavarius King, the prankster, died as he was being taken to the hospital. And here's the problem. Because there is no just punishment for vandalism, punishment is meted out, however unjustly. You know, most vandals, they just get away with it. And that's unjust. And then some are murdered when a local citizen who's just irate about the fact that vandalism has run rampant ends up shooting the punk. And that's unjust. So whether they get away with it or whether they get murdered for it, it's unjust. And the blood is on the hands of the justice system and the legislatures who fail to implement just punishment for vandalism. So most get away with it. Some are murdered. Which is worse? Well, of course, the murder of the young punk throwing the egg is much worse. But they're both equally intolerable. And they're both equally corrosive to the ideals of justice, here in the last great hope for freedom and justice on God's green earth, the United States of America. And so justice denied turns into murder right there in Atlanta over the throwing of an egg into a Mercedes. So there you have the state of justice. Well, we've got a lot more. We've got a pretty thick justice file this week. Pretty thick. I want to talk about life. I'm going to talk a lot about life in today's show, but let's start out in Kennewick, Washington, from the Associated Press. A Washington woman convicted of murdering a pregnant woman and cutting the baby from her womb has been sentenced to life in prison. Now, the baby survived and is now living with his father. And for some reason, the prosecutors declined to seek the death penalty in the case. So here we have a murderer who kills a woman, cuts the baby from the woman's womb, leaves the woman to bleed to death, and the prosecutor declined to seek the death penalty in the case. Can there be any reason in anyone's mind that a prosecutor would decline to seek the death penalty in the case, in this particularly heinous case? Could there be any reason except perhaps that everyone in the justice system, in the legislatures, in the government, from the governor, from the president on down, have all forgotten what justice is? It's the Weekly Worldview, and I would point you back to a time in our not-too-distant past here in the United States of America when the Supreme Court authorized the negligence of justice, beginning in the 60s and the 70s, culminated with Roe versus Wade, the authority of the states to abandon their responsibility to protect every life. And since the justice system and the minions who work in it, the apparatchiks, which is what they've become, since they've been trained and taught to discard justice, well, that's exactly what they do day in and day out, every day, here in the good old U.S. of A. And it is life that is the very first right that was mentioned in the Declaration of Independence. It's the very first right that's codified in the Constitution of the United States. No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or process without due life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and all that. Well, that's all been discarded now for a generation. And so, what do we expect to happen? But prosecutors, judges, lawyers, governors, legislators, presidents, to have completely lost their moorings from their original responsibilities. And so it's put us on a path where even the most heinous of murderers are given life, and the most innocent and defenseless amongst us are given death, are murdered. All right, more from the justice file. From Deer Lodge, Montana, a Montana judge last Wednesday scheduled a January 31st execution date for the only known Canadian on death row in the United States. Ronald Allen Smith has been ordered to be executed January 31st of next year. Smith was convicted in 1983 of fatally shooting Harvey Mann and Thomas Running Rabbit there in the great state of Montana. He shot them execution style in the woods. So, can I put more of a point on my point? Scheduled to be executed January 31st. We'll keep an eye on this story. Because there's a lot of time between now and then. A lot of things could happen between now and 2011. And I'm going to touch on that a little bit later in the broadcast, too. What could happen between now and 2011 that could change the playing field, so to speak. A game changer. Isn't that the popular phrase now? A game changer coming in 2011, do you think? Perhaps? All right. Well, here is an update on one of the most heinous cases in the history of justice in the United States, the home invasion in New Haven, Connecticut, that you've all read about and that we've talked about here. Two men broke into a home, forced the mother to withdraw money before attempting to kill the father and then killing the mother, burning the children in the house. Well, we're in the sentencing phase of that trial, which inexplicably, the sentencing phase began Thursday of last week and continues to this very moment, which is, it's mind-boggling. Well, an attorney in that case told a jury last Thursday that in regards to his defendant, he said that a life sentence in prison would actually be harsher than a death sentence for the Connecticut man who killed a woman and her two daughters in that home invasion, because the client is so haunted by the crime and isolated in prison. So do you get that? The defense lawyer is begging for the man's life by telling the jury that imposing a life sentence would be harsher than executing this murderer. And, of course, the jury that's been selected here in post-Christian America has no idea what a harsh sentence meeting your creator after such a heinous crime would be. And so they may buy into this load of malarkey. The murderer, by the way, what's his name here? This piece of human offal. Stephen Hayes. Stephen Hayes was convicted of sexually assaulting and strangling Jennifer Hawk Pettit at her Cheshire, Connecticut home back in 07. Authorities say her daughters died of smoke inhalation after they were tied to their beds, doused with gasoline, and the house was set ablaze. We're 3 days into the sentencing phase. This Hayes dirtbag has already been convicted, and the jury can't figure out what to do with him. Is it any wonder that the conservative tsunami that was expected in the 2011 midterms, I'm sorry, the 2010 midterms, Is it any wonder that it resulted in a fizzle rather than a spark? I think if there's anything that the 2010 midterms have taught us is that a vast majority of the people, the electorate anyway, I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt and say that they're genuinely deceived. But I'm also suspicious that they're just evil. Just evil. And they're going to cling to their evil rebellion up until a catastrophic event turns them on a dime to begging for justice, begging for righteousness. Those people who have put into power those politicians that lie, who have allowed laws and judicial rulings that are lies to rule the day so that they could pursue the lusts of their flesh, those same people will turn on a dime and beg for righteousness. They will be on their knees begging for righteousness. Okay, I've gotten ahead of myself. These people in this jury who have spent the better part of 3 days trying to figure out what to do with the most heinous type of murderer. Could it be that they're just deceived and stupid? I think it could be. I hate to ponder the alternative that the vast majority of the American citizenry is just flat out post-Christian evil. I hate to ponder that. All right, let's return to this story from New Haven. This dirtbag, Stephen Hayes, and his co-defendant, according to court testimony, tormented the family for 7 hours before strangling and burning them to death. But the attorney, their defense attorney, has the nerve to stand up in front of the jury and say, quote, "This is a human being," he says, pointing to Stephen Hayes, who set an 11-year-old and a 17-year-old girl on fire after raping and murdering their mother. The lawyer has the audacity to stand up and say, Stephen Hayes, quote, "is a human being. You may despise what he did, but he's not a rabid dog that needs to be put down," unquote. The lawyer then goes on to say, a life sentence would be, quote, "a fate worse than death for the murderer," proving that he is unqualified to enter into any level of debate on any issue of the day, yet he's a lawyer. Anyway, as we go to air, there has been no decision as to what we shall do with Stephen Hayes for his crime. And the jury sits there, potentially bamboozled by a lawyer who doesn't understand that there is no fate worse than death for Stephen Hayes. And there also is no opportunity for his redemption outside of that death penalty. It's a sad state of affairs, justice here in the United States. And one more, just in case you were holding on to any thread of hope that there was any sense of justice left anywhere in the nation. Let's go to Newark, New Jersey. The Associated Press. A man who admitted pulling the trigger in the execution-style killing of three college students in a New Jersey schoolyard has been sentenced to life. He has been given his life by a judge. Melvin Jovell pleaded guilty just days before his trial was to begin, apparently saving the judge and the courts there in New Jersey a good bit of time and paperwork. And for that, he was rewarded with his life. He was sentenced last Thursday to three consecutive life sentences plus 20 years just for good measure. A ridiculous, ludicrous sentence. But not a surprise. Not a surprise. For more than a generation now, not only our justice system, but the media and the public in general has been taught, how should I put it? Not brainwashed. That's too strong of a term. We haven't been brainwashed, but we have been conditioned. We have been conditioned to disrespect justice. When the government was given the authority to abandon their responsibility to defend the very first right that our founders ordered them to preserve. From that day forward, it has been a slow march into hell. And that hell is being experienced by the families of these three college students murdered execution style, by the husband who survived the home invasion there in New Haven, one family, one citizen at a time. We're on our way to hell. These people are going through hell on earth. All right. Now, can I go right into the domestic tranquility file? I'm afraid I might just hang up and just. All right. Let's do this from Los Angeles, California, the Associated Press. A man who authorities say deliberately ran his truck into the bedroom where his newborn baby and her mother were sleeping, was charged last Wednesday with 2 counts of murder and 6 counts of attempted murder. The baby and her mother, sleeping in the bedroom, were killed when his vehicle crashed through the room. 6 others were in the house, 1 other seriously injured. Eduardo Villarreal was charged with murder under special circumstances of multiple murder, making him eligible for the death penalty, though prosecutors have not yet decided whether they'll seek the death penalty because they're genuinely deceived or ignorant, or perhaps a generation since the abandonment of justice, perhaps they're just evil. Because failure to administer justice, well, it's more than just a sin of omission. It becomes a sin of commission. Anyway, back to Los Angeles. The mother's three-year-old child from another father was also in the bedroom but was not hurt. Just a small commentary on the state of the culture. We'll talk more about that later. Villarreal told investigators he deliberately drove into the house but says he was only trying to kill himself. And he has survived, at least for the moment. All right, let's see. Okay, so I happened to mention that the three-year-old child from another father was also in the bedroom but was not hurt, thank God. Well, listen to this, folks. Just pulled this down off the wire. We all know that what the statistics tell us. So here's the AP confirming what we all know. Statistics show that children of unmarried mothers of any race are more likely to perform poorly in school, go to prison, use drugs, be poor as adults, and have their own children out of wedlock. Well, the numbers are in. Everybody's been paying attention as the numbers rolled in from the 2010 midterms as we all sat on the edge of our seats watching Fox News, waiting for the conservative tsunami, and we watched as 10%, 15%, 20%, 30%, as the vote rolled in. Well, here are the numbers that really matter, folks, and they're only going one way, and it's not a conservative tsunami. Here we go, folks. The black community, well, the rate of illegitimate birth in the black community is 72%. Asians, 17%. Whites, 29%. Hispanics, 53%. Native Americans, 66%. That's the illegitimacy rate broken down by cultural group. The rate for the overall U.S. population is 41%. 41% of babies born in the United States of America, the last great hope for truth and justice on the planet, are born out of wedlock. And the Associated Press notes at the end of the article, the issue of illegitimacy entered the public consciousness back in 1965 when a government report by Patrick Moynihan described what he called a, quote, tangle of pathology, unquote, among blacks. So did you catch that? The issue of illegitimacy didn't even really enter the public consciousness in the United States until 1965 because it wasn't much of an issue, frankly, before the welfare state got its hooks into the black family. Well, that report back in 1965, Daniel Patrick Moynihan was trying to raise an alarm because he was quite disturbed and thought that it should be a cause of concern that the illegitimacy rate among the black family was 24%. 24% in 1965, 72% just some 45 years later. And the numbers just keep coming in, folks, and they're only going one way. And it's not a favorable direction. So I want to ask you a question, America. When you were 7 or 8 years old, maybe you were playing in the sand lot, playing with your friends, before you ever encountered what's been called the abortion debate, you knew that a pregnant woman was carrying a person. You knew that. when you were 7 or 8. Before you ever heard, before you cared anything about politics, you knew. So I want to talk about the election returns, especially here in Colorado, where Amendment 62 picked up 3 more points. We went from 27% in 2008 to 30% in 2010, a 10% improvement over our last outing, so considerable. That's the cup half full view of things. And I got a couple of reasons to think the cup's half full, a couple of reasons to think the cup's half empty. But I want to start by letting everyone out there who has a desire that our laws tell the truth. And shouldn't we all have a desire that the law tell the truth? We should all have a desire for that. And if you do, well, be of good cheer. Because every single person who voted against the personhood of the unborn child in Colorado at one point in their life knew that it was a person. So it's simply a matter of us returning them to what they already knew. And I think there's hope for that. Because one thing I noticed in the hundreds and hundreds of phone calls I made and conversations that I had over the course of the campaign, one thing I noticed is that pro-choicers, people who call themselves pro-choice, they're not proud of it. They're not out there waving the banner for abortion. I mean, there are, of course, the NARAL, the clenched-jawed, clipped-haired types that Michael Savage refers to that obviously are proud of as many babies as they can kill and as many lies as they can tell and as many laws as they can write and pass in order to deceive the children. There are those, and there will always be those. That's a small percentage. The average pro-choice Democrat is not proud of the fact that they're pro-choice. In fact, it's like pulling teeth to get them to even talk about it. And so I think their position is vulnerable. You know? I'm not sure that we have enough volunteers or enough money to reach them. Short of a 20-year effort. I was having a conversation with another volunteer. He said, well, heck it, Doug, at this rate, it'll take us 10 years. And I said, well, do the math, my friend. I think it's closer to 20. And we both said, well, yeah, that's probably true. But their position is vulnerable because it's based on a lie. So we have the truth on our side. Not that that helped a lot of the prophets in the Bible. They had the truth on their side, too. And, you know, an awful lot of them ended up with their heads on a platter, at least in the short term. But I think we've also learned, or at least I have, that a significant plurality of pro-choice voters are genuinely deceived. They've avoided the issue because it's an uncomfortable issue, and they've arrived at the position that they feel is politically correct. I mean, what's easier to say at a party? That you're pro-life or pro-choice? Well, probably neither, because nobody ever wants to talk about this issue at a dinner party. But just in the general course of daily life, they've found it a lot easier to get along by just saying they're pro-choice. And so they're reachable, I think. I hope. And maybe I'm being Pollyanna. But I think they're reachable. Well, do I want to do any more? Well, anyway, the glass is half empty, frankly. The glass is half empty, but there is potential out there. But we can't give up. And let's, in fact, on that note, let's move to this story from the Washington Times. Mississippi voters will have a personhood measure on their 2011 ballots. Yeah, circuit court judge there in Mississippi has cleared the way for Measure 26. Interesting. Numerologically, we go from Colorado 62 to 26 in Mississippi, where our work comes to an end with 62. God's work continues with a new beginning, 26 there in Mississippi. The personhood amendment, as of now, will be on the 2011 ballot. According to the Washington Times, Measure 26 would amend the Mississippi Constitution to say that the term person or persons shall include every human being from the moment of fertilization, cloning, or the functional equivalent thereof. Now, that's a scientifically true statement. Scientifically, philosophically, politically true. And I think that when you debate with liberals, when you ask them, should the law tell the truth, unless they're just willfully ignorant and evil, they should say, yes, the law should tell the truth. The law should defend the truth against lies. No truer statement has ever been issued. No truer statement will have ever been on the ballot before the citizenry of Mississippi in 2011. And I wish them the best on that. Let's see, a lawyer who was representing plaintiffs Deborah Hughes, ACLU, and Kristen Hemmons, Planned Parenthood. Not necessarily in that order, but certainly those two groups. He said, quote, despite the disappointing ruling, that was the ruling the judge gave, allowing the personhood vote. He said, despite the disappointing ruling, we remain confident that our legal position is correct, that Measure 26 is unconstitutional. So they say putting the question to the voters is unconstitutional. What I want to see is I want to see a courtroom debate over whether or not the question is correct. And in fact, I want to know what is the answer to the question of personhood. If the government refuses to define it, perhaps we, the people, shall have to do it for them. And they will have an opportunity in 2011 to do just that in the great state of Mississippi. And when I said the glass is half empty, well, I don't mean to be dour or down. I'm a realist. And I'm afraid that perhaps the only thing that the electorate here in America, well, definitely here in Colorado, I think the electorate has proven that the only thing they will understand is catastrophe, that there is going to have to be catastrophe put upon them before they stop on a dime and beg for righteousness. Now, we're going to give them their third chance here in Mississippi. They've had two strikes here in Colorado. We're going to give them their third pitch there in Mississippi. And I have a feeling, I have a sneaking suspicion, that by the time the 2011 elections roll around in Mississippi, there will be something of a catastrophe facing the voters in the United States of America. Something of a catastrophe. We shall see whether it's enough to make the people who want to exercise their rebellion against God and pursue the lusts of their flesh above all other things, if it's enough of a catastrophe to make them stop on a dime and beg for righteousness and finally tell the truth, I do not know. But I do believe I do believe that, how does it go? Three strikes and you're out, I believe, is the old axiom. So we're laying up a softball for y'all out there in Mississippi. And so I hope you swing true, voters of Mississippi. All right. Now, let's move on. Oh, should I talk about this question of rape and incest? I think I should address this. Whenever you ask a nominally pro-choice, moderate Republican or a Democrat about the person of the unborn child and does the unborn child have a right to life, the first thing out of their mouth, almost in a robotic fashion, is, well, what if a woman is raped? What about incest? That's the very first two things. So I have to give credit where credit is due, in that Lucifer and his minions has done a wonderful job, a wonderfully effective job, of brainwashing the people into just mechanically regurgitating this dramatic concern they have for rape and incest victims. And let me state that rape and incest are among the most horrible crimes that can be committed, and I sympathize with the victims, as does everyone associated with the pro-life movement. And the question has been asked, should a rape victim be compelled by law to carry the baby to term? And I believe the answer to that question is no. I believe the answer to that question is no. A rape victim should not be compelled by the law to carry that baby to term. Now, the responsibility of the government to protect every life overrides that woman's right to not carry that baby. But I do believe that in light of this question, that the government is obligated to launch and fund scientific research to devise a solution for a woman who finds herself pregnant due to an assault against her will. I believe the government is responsible and obligated to find a solution. I believe that we should launch and fund scientific research to bring the smallest embryo, zygote, one cell, to bring that person from a state of single cell life to birth or something the equivalent of birth. Do you think medical science can do it? I think we must. I think the government is obligated and should begin the effort immediately, and I believe that if we commit ourselves morally, financially, and politically to the effort, that we can find a solution within the decade. Right. I mean, we put a man on the moon, right? Huh? Kennedy challenged us to do it within a decade, and we did it. Certainly believe we could do this, and I believe the government is obligated if one looks at it from a rational legal perspective. So there you have that. All right, now I'm running out of time, and I've got more news than I wanted to. Well, we'll have to go quickly through a lot of these stories here at the end. Three Iowa justices who voted to legalize homosexual marriage were ousted in the 2010 midterms. Yeah. And because of that, the Iowa government's concerned that there's likely to be delays in issuing rulings. The court will be able to function, they say, however, at a much slower pace. I say fine. I mean, I think on balance, the Supreme Court of any given state does more harm than good these days. So anything to slow them down is probably worthwhile. And that was one of the shining bright spots in what I considered a pretty lousy showing for conservatives in the 2010 midterm elections. I mean, I was of the opinion that if it was less than 80 seats and the conservatives didn't get the Senate, basically it was just 1994 redux and forget about it. It's meaningless, relatively. Relatively meaningless. All right. Let's go to New York from the personhood file. This is just... Here's where we are, ladies and gentlemen. This is what happens when a polity is taught and trained to disregard human life, especially at its most vulnerable stage. From New York, the Associated Press, the death of an emaciated 4-year-old girl found in her New York City home last month has been ruled a homicide. Marcella Pierce died of child abuse syndrome, including acute drug poisoning, blunt impact injuries, malnutrition, and dehydration. Her mother's been charged with assault, endangering the welfare of a child, and drug possession. This 4-year-old girl weighed 18 pounds when she died on September 2nd. You see, the humanity of every child has been undermined. Now, this is the extreme example of what happens. But the combative attitude of parents toward their children, you see it every day in the grocery store. Bring up, in your workplace, bring up the idea of having another child and see the reaction of your coworkers. It's as if you've pronounced a curse upon yourself. I mean, you go to the grocery store and you watch kids and their parents, it's like they're at war. And the attitudes of adults toward children and child rearing and child bearing is overtly not just negative, but combative. You know, the way children are referred to in conversations between adults, they're referred to primarily as problems, inconveniences, trouble, hell, make my life hell. I mean, this is where we've come in this generation. This is a stiff-necked and rebellious generation. And perhaps the only thing they will understand is fire. And I mean that figuratively. Well, it may be coming. It may be coming. Listen to this from the economics file from the Reuters Wire. An advisor to the Chinese central bank, Jiabin, has stated in a commentary in the Financial News, a Chinese language newspaper, he has commented on the Fed's decision to purchase $600 billion in United States Treasury notes. And he said, quote, as long as the world exercises no restraint in issuing global currency such as the dollar, and this is not easy, then the occurrence of another crisis is inevitable, as quite a few wise Westerners lament. This is Jiabin, who's a Chinese fellow. And he's referring to, as I said, the Federal Reserve is buying $600 billion in government bonds, basically setting all of us up for what I have long feared, and that is round two of the economic crisis, as the inflation monster roars out of from the depths, and the value of our money drops, and I believe that. We've set ourselves, you know, once you abandon the very first principle that your government is responsible for, protecting life, it's very hard then to talk economic sense. It's very hard to talk people out of stealing when they're already participating in murder. Okay? And perhaps this will be the catastrophe. That causes the wicked people, the wicked majority, to beg for righteousness. Perhaps this is the catastrophe that puts every American at a crossroads to choose between tyranny and righteousness. And perhaps righteousness will carry the day. Certainly the infrastructure is there. It's been rebuilt over the past few years, I believe, by God-fearing Christian Americans who have shouted from the rooftops that we return to protecting that very first fundamental right of life. But perhaps all this stiff-necked and rebellious generation will understand is fire. And when the fire comes down upon them and they're afraid of being consumed, perhaps then they will give up their lust against the lives of the innocent. You know, something I learned during this campaign, and I think something that the Republicans and the Tea Partiers in particular have failed to understand, is that a significant plurality of nominally pro-choice Democrat, independent, Republican voters, when they're concerned about the economy, when they're concerned about their wallet and their job and food on their table, they will concede the abortion issue at the ballot box. And I think that Ken Buck really proved this. I mean, Ken Buck threw the pro-life community in Colorado under the bus during the campaign and said, in essence, I'm not going to cater to these personhood people for 2% of the vote. Well, Ken Buck lost by only 15,000 votes. And I tried to tell his campaign that, you know, the personhood effort here in Colorado, we motivated 600,000 people at the ballot back in 08. And I wrote them a message, and I said, you know, that out of that 600,000, there's 60,000 of us who are hardcore. We are not going to compromise on the life of not even one innocent child. And Ken, you could lose this by less than 60,000 if you're not careful. Well, Ken lost by 15,000 votes, roughly. And what he didn't realize, what the Tea Partiers don't realize, that in avoiding this issue of the fundamental right to life, is that when the fire starts to consume the people's money, and they get afraid about losing their house and their job, and they're afraid about putting food on their table, they'll abandon the pro-abortion issue in a heartbeat. They'll abandon the lusts of the flesh, and they'll beg for righteousness. They'll beg for it. And perhaps 2011, perhaps in Mississippi, the pro-life movement will finally find that synergy between crisis and the truth. A people faced with crisis will beg for the truth. They will forget about all their secondary political issues like the right to kill innocent unborn children. They'll abandon all of that if you'll put bread on their table. And I think the only politicians who will be able to convince those who are in fear for their lives and their livelihoods will be politicians who stand up for that first fundamental right of life. Those politicians will be believed because the people will thirst for righteousness. They will thirst for truth because they will know that truth will be the only thing that will stave off the fire that is about to consume them. All right, now I've run out of time. Let's see. From CNN, Obama has restored the creator to his recitations of the Declaration of Independence. Yeah, in 4 speeches in 3 days, just the past few days, he mentioned the creator every time. Hey, Barry, it's too late. The jig's up. We already know who you are. Let's see. I don't care about this story from South Africa. Solar panel maker plans to lay off, not expanding. Eliminating 175 jobs. This is the same company that Barry Ho toured, that one of these solar panel companies. They were going to add 2,000 jobs when Barry was there. Turns out they're not adding any. They're cutting some. And, well, by next year, I'm sure they'll all be gone. Let's see here. Oh, here we go from the French press agency. Big news from the UN. An UN panel has called for increased taxes on carbon emissions and international transportation to raise $100 billion a year to combat climate change and employ thousands of relatives and mistresses of panel members. Yeah, that's big news out of the UN this week. The Happy Meal has been outlawed in San Francisco. That's just great. I don't care about that. The British, there's some people in Britain who are saying you shouldn't shower more than once a week. That doesn't surprise anyone. Okay, here we go. Important news. Christchurch, New Zealand, from the Associated Press. It seems that Hillary Clinton, well, everywhere she goes, well, there's an earthquake. Well, not everywhere, but almost. As her plane landed last Friday in Christchurch, New Zealand, the city was hit by an aftershock from a 7-magnitude earthquake. As she wrapped up a trip to Papua New Guinea back in September, a 6.0-magnitude quake rattled Papua New Guinea. Yeah, on her first trip abroad as Secretary of State, February 2009, Clinton was shaken awake by an earthquake in Japan, and 4 months later, while she was in Honduras, a 5.0 struck. And then, in October 2009, tremors struck Pakistan while Hillary Rodham Clinton was there, for whatever that's worth. It's her thunder thighs? Now that's just unacceptable. All right. Finally, on that note, thunder thighs indeed. Vice President Joe Biden's motorcade has been involved in at least 5 crashes. And Forbes says that that's an unusually high number. for a vice presidential motorcade. Now, I haven't paid attention to this issue, but I don't ever recall a motorcade being involved in an accident. But listen to this. Forbes tells us while it's not uncommon for presidential and vice presidential motorcades to be involved in crashes, it is rare. There are usually just one or two reported incidents in an 8-year stint in office by any given president or vice president. And Joe Biden, well, apparently he's in a hurry as he takes the country ever closer to the rim of hell. He wants to get there just as fast as he can, and he's willing to run over just about anybody who's in his way. I guess that's the takeaway there. Well, that's it, folks. That's the week as it was, and we look forward to the week and the year that shall be. I want to thank you for joining us. With the Lord's goodwill, I'll be back with you next week. And until then, I want to thank my friends at KGov Radio, at Personhood USA, at American Right to Life, all those good folks. And, of course, my other brother, Daryl, who makes it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios. And, of course, I want to thank my extremely, extremely attractive audio engineer for being at the controls today. We'll be back with you next week. And until then, may the grace of God go with you. And may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.